Good morning, you may be seated. The first case on our calendar is 06443 Columbus Bar Association versus Stephen Linen. Mr. Stern.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and the opportunity for Mr. Linen to address the court.
Watch your time.
Thank you. There are three aspects to our argument this morning: admitted misconduct, findings of the panel and the board, and mitigation. Mr. Linen has repeatedly, in hearings under oath, acknowledged the grievous wrongdoing in which he engaged. He has called it, and I quote, absolutely reprehensible conduct. On his behalf and with his authorization, we have stipulated the violation of two disciplinary rules, 1102A3, illegal conduct involving moral turpitude, and 1102A6, conduct adversely reflecting on fitness to practice. We have nonetheless, from the briefing and from the hearing, introduced evidence of what is stated to be in the rules of this court a mental defect, a mitigating mental defect. In this case, exhibitionism, obsessive compulsive category of exhibitionism, as we all know from the facts of the case, exercised over a period of time with the multiple victims. We come to this court this morning respectfully requesting a balanced view of this misconduct mitigation, with the purposes of course, protecting the public, the traditional purpose of the disciplinary system, and advancing the recovery, the rehabilitation of afflicted or addictive lawyers in the system. This is a matter, without trying to gild or flatter the court too much, has brought this court national attention. Since 1988, at least, when the Michaels case came down, identifying the disciplinary system as a tool of recovery, and well, it has been. Consistently, since 1988, up to very recent cases, the Young case of 2004 or 5, the Washington case, the Ashton case, all recognizing the aspect, the ameliorating effect of the disciplinary system as a tool of recovery.
Mr. Stern, you've asked us in your brief to temper the board's recommended sanction without suggesting what the sanction should be. Do you have a recommended sanction?
A term suspension, Your Honor.
A term suspension, 2 years or
yes,
less?
If the court feels, obviously, we would request consideration of staying. Perhaps it would depend on the court's assessment, we believe, of the conduct and the mitigation.
But speaking of the mitigation, there appears to be no psychological treatment for this, that they can be positive that this will not happen again.
Well, with all due respect, there is psychological treatment in here, as Dr. Moss.
I know there's treatment, but there's no. In the report, it says that, you know, they're not sure that this will be effective.
Well, at one place in the report, I think without any basis, they indicated a belief that there was perhaps a high degree of possible recidivism. There's just no basis for that kind of assertion. What we have in this case, Justice Resnick, is the testimony of Dr. Maas, the testimony of the associate director of OLAP, clearly indicating their belief. I'm sure no one could say to the possibility, a probability of 100%, though, that recidivism or substitute conduct is unlikely. We, of course, are relying on the four aspects of the mitigation in Board Regulation 10b-2 and on matters like the Linen case. There's another Linen case this court has already decided, L-I-N-N-O-N, as contrasted to L-I-N-N-E-N, which clearly recognizes a mental disability as a mitigation. Given this history, I would like to move to the board report and some of the statements that are made in the board report and to compare or contrast those with the record in the case. The board says, the panel and then the board says that Mr. Linen lacked remorse. Mr. Linen never apologized. Mr. Linen didn't care. We have reviewed the record as carefully as we know how. There are 14 places in that record where he is self-condemning, apologetic, humbled. Let me give you one example. When he went before Judge Tommy Thompson in the criminal case, ultimately sentenced to 18 months of work release, a fine, and now 5 years probation, he said, this is a year before the disciplinary case where they said he had no remorse. And I quote from Mr. Linen under oath, I realized that my pattern of conduct was reprehensible and it was wrong. I personally would like to apologize to any of the victims who may be here today. I would also like to apologize to the community. I would like to apologize to law enforcement who obviously had to spend some of their time in dealing with my conduct. I am absolutely committed to a different course of conduct today. Mr. Linen inserted voluntarily a disclosure in every fee agreement he had as to his record, his arrest, and so forth, and had acknowledgments by clients who continued with him. There's another anomaly, and this was touched on by Justice Resnick. The panel seemed to feel that the fact that he was treated by a clinical psychologist for exhibitionism, for the sexual addiction, was somehow enfeebling in regard to the treatment, that perhaps there should have been medication. I don't know, and I cannot represent to this court, what medication, if any, is efficacious with exhibitionism. I shouldn't say my own view, but in any event, we have that criticism. Not only is there a departure, I would respectfully suggest, in these key points in the panel and board report, but the cases that the Columbus Bar Association cites in its brief in support of its recommendation to you of an indefinite suspension are, I would respectfully suggest, a substantial deviance from the situation here. They cite the Golden case, which involved over 20 violations of the disciplinary rules, including an A4, fraud, deceit, dishonesty, or misrepresentation, which they agreed to drop at the hearing and which the panel agreed with. Failure to cooperate. Mr. Linen, of course, has been undisputedly the absolute antithesis of that. He has cooperated, and continues to cooperate. The McKinney case, same thing, an A4, fraud, deceit, dishonesty, misrepresentation. It's not there in this case. Commingling in that case, not here. Intentionally prejudicing clients, not here.
Mr. Stern, I know you said that the admission is to two disciplinary violations, but should we look to the underlying situation of how many different instances there were in this particular case?
Yes, sure. I mean, recognize that, Your Honor. He recognizes that. Yes, well, we're asking this court to do, which it has done so many times, is to balance. Balance that. Balance the number of violations. Look at the mitigation and divine a decision.
Counsel, you indicated that no harm to clients, and you were going through a laundry list of things that did not happen, we would face the same dilemma or question every time we look at discipline, where the underlying problem is a criminal offense that had no connection to clients. We see this in the drug area, all kinds of drug abuse, some just personal to the lawyer, others involving drug transactions with other people. But in all of those cases, I think the discipline is generally fairly severe, even though clients aren't involved at all. Would that be a fair representation of the history of our discipline?
I certainly couldn't agree in all the cases, because I think, as I have been reminded by this court for some years in these arguments, each case stands on its own.
Right.
And we would have a case like the opinion you wrote in Smith, where we had 8 disciplinary violations and no time off, 6 months stayed. So I think it's there. The conduct here is egregious. How one melds that in with a set of rules that are primarily designed in the attorney-client relationship is speculative in that regard.
That's the problem here, isn't it?
No, it is.
You're asking a specific timeout rather than indefinite, which allows application for reinstatement after 2 years. What is he doing now?
He is practicing law, representing economically disadvantaged clients at an hourly of 75, I believe.
All right. And what was he doing at the time these events occurred?
He was the tax counsel at the House of Representatives for the majority.
Okay, so he was, at that time, didn't have individual clients as such. He represented
an
institution rather than having a number of clients that he was interacting with at the time.
And he also, after this took place, he voluntarily relinquished practice for about a year, resumed the practice because it was an adjunct to the work release requirements, that he have something to do in that regard, and if he didn't, he could have faced a more severe penalty.
Right.
Mr. Stern, if we were to accept your suggestion that Mr. Linen receive a definite sanction, surely we'd want to add conditions to that, I would think. Even Dr. Mass says that there could be a regression under stress, if the person is under stress. With, as Justice Piper's indicated, with the indefinite suspension, as you know, you well know, the court has the opportunity, the system has the opportunity to review the person's conduct during the period that they've been removed from the practice of law and then evaluate the propriety of their being readmitted. Surely we'd want to do that in this instance, would we not? If we were to take your suggestion that he receive, let's say, for instance, a 2-year definite sanction.
Oh, yes, sir. Very much so, Mr. Chief Justice.
How is that for your client? How is that much different than an indefinite suspension?
It is. Well, I should say we've already stipulated to whatever conditions were suggested. How is it different? In today's disciplinary procedure, a petition for reinstatement going from the beginning with this whole laundry list of people who are noticed on it, the hearing, the board report, the coming before this court, and so on, I would respectfully submit, takes in excess of 3 years total. The conditions in an indefinite suspension and in a definite suspension can be identical. This court certainly has the power to do that. And the Obviously, I would say that those are the major difference, so plus the matter of resources.
The practical benefit would be he would be, assuming everything worked the way it's supposed to work, he would be readmitted much quicker if there was a definite sanction with a condition versus indefinite suspension. That's your...
In our experience, Your Honor, a two-year definite... depending on the conditions, an IME or some of these, but it would be certainly closer to 2 years, 2 years, 2 months, 2 years, 3 months, something like that. I think an indefinite suspension for the factors I mentioned would involve at least a year. Very quickly, there's a case footnoted by the bar talking about a Kansas case of sex with clients, which we respectfully submit is not as close to, as a one-year later Kansas case that involved serial exhibitionism. The Kansas Supreme Court suspended for 3 years. We complete by pointing out the various factors in mitigation that are amply shown here. The OLAP viewpoint that this man's recovery on a scale of 1 or 0 to 10 has been a 10. The positive findings of two judges of the Franklin County Common Pleas Court, the recommendation of his former spouse as to his interaction with her and their child. There is an old adage, we all know it, that the Supreme Court reads the newspapers. I don't think it was referring to this Supreme Court. I think it was referring to our friends in Washington. But nonetheless, we respectfully request that this matter be reviewed by this court on the evidence, on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. Mr. Frick.
Thank you, Chief Justice. If it please the court, my name is Bradley Frick, F-R-I-C-K, 1265 Neal Avenue in Columbus, counsel for Relator Columbus Bar Association. As you know, the respondent has already admitted to violations of DR 1102A 3 and 6, which include conduct involving moral turpitude and conduct adversely reflecting his fitness to practice law. You heard Mr. Stern just a moment ago use the word egregious.
Counsel, before you address that, would you zero in on the representations made in the report that there was a failure to exhibit remorse, to apologize, to acknowledge to the victims and to the system that there was wrongdoing on behalf of Mr. Lennon, which, according to Mr. Stern, I believe he said there's at least 14 incidences in the record that he pointed to that could, that in fact do state his remorse and his apologies.
The record speaks for itself. However, I think the easiest thing to do for a respondent in his position is to apologize at trial. I think the concern was that there was very little remorse and very little apology and very little effort given by Mr. Lennon toward his victims.
At what point?
When should there have been?
I'm confused as to what the bar or the Columbus Bar's expectations were.
I don't know that they were the bar's expectations. We didn't ask him to apologize. That was a concern of the panel. It also, by the way, happens to be the testimony of Dr. Moss. When he was asked what Mr. Lennon could have done, one of his responses was he could have apologized. We didn't raise that issue. They did.
Well, what would you have him do? You certainly wouldn't have him phone up these victims and say, I'm sorry, would you? I mean, that would seem to be a further invasion of their privacy.
Perhaps. This isn't about apologies. This man is a serial misdemeanor.
Except Mr. Frick, the panel seemed to think it was. I mean, at least one reason, it seems to me, that, I mean, they say it, that they recommended the sanction they did was because he did not apologize to his victims. It seemed like I took it that their impression was that he didn't seem to have any regret, but then the respondent, as you know, in their brief, cites to the transcript in which he says what he would have said to them if he was allowed to. And it seems to me like that's expressing regret. I don't know why it is not. So Well, there's something that's not coming together here, I guess, that I'd like to hear your comment on.
Well, the record does speak for itself, but it also contains Mr. Linden's testimony that essentially sets forth that this was really all about him. It was all about him when he was committing these acts. It was all about him when he got caught. When he got caught, he said, oh no, I've got a real problem now. Everything I've worked for is lost. From that moment forward, until the hearing, as far as I know, there was no expression of apology or remorse. But I can't speak for the panel's concern. But remember,
could you have gone back to Judge Thompson, and Judge Thompson's the one who said don't have any contact with the victims.
Actually,
He
didn't. Scott Vanderkar, municipal judge,
okay,
did.
Okay, the judge, whichever
and
judge.
And that order expired prior to the determination of the felony conviction. I'm sorry, the misdemeanor convictions.
Should he, is it your view, should he have returned to the judge or request the judge to permit him to appropriately make by letter or something to make apologies to them? Or is that,
well, he could have. He certainly could have, but he would not have gone. He did not have to go back to the court, but it's certainly something he could have done.
Because the order had expired, is that your?
Correct. The municipal court judge issued that order at the bond hearing. That expired.
Counsel, one of the things we look at is the harm to the victim, and we have struggled with this issue recently in the finding of panels saying there's no harm when intuitively we would think otherwise from what has happened. Judge Thompson made that comment that there was no harm to the victims. Can you address that issue?
Yes. He pled to 53 misdemeanor counts. Included in those misdemeanor counts are public indecency, sexual imposition, multiple counts, and aggravated trespass. All of the victims, of which there were between 30 and 40, were women. They were clearly affected by this. The testimony of one of the witnesses, Ms. Kellogg, clearly reflects the fear and the ramifications of what Mr. Linden's actions were. But I think there's another victim here, and I think the victim is the bar. This case has brought to the front and to the news media this system. And I think that he has brought dishonor to the system, to our profession. I think he has robbed it of goodwill. I think that the public looks to this case to see whether or not we can police our own. And I think arguably the bar is a victim.
Counsel, isn't that the big rub in this case, and perhaps a departure, because while we say, and we have the rule bringing dishonor to the profession, as Mr. Stern has indicated, the focus generally is on the individual, the harm to the clients, the harm to the public. This is a huge embarrassment to the bar. And should that rise above or take on greater importance than it ordinarily does in these cases?
This is a case of first impression. There is no other case like this anywhere. What is unique about it is that there are 53 counts pled to with 30 to 40 victims. It is different than a lawyer who steals from a trust account or otherwise. It's an entirely different situation.
Isn't that a huge embarrassment to the bar also, when a lawyer steals from clients? Seems to me that's a monumental embarrassment to the bar. Or when a lawyer runs a drug dealer's client money through the firm books and essentially is a launderer for a drug dealer. I mean, we see lots of cases that are an embarrassment to the bar. I think we all continue to be shocked that these things can happen within our profession.
Well, clearly in those two examples, there may have been a victim or two, or maybe even a dozen, but there weren't 40. This is truly a unique case. It's important to also look at Dr. Moss's testimony, because if your assumption is that there's a confirmed mental disability here, you've got to look very closely at Dr. Moss's testimony. To begin with, he provided what he called a provisional diagnosis, and for some unusual reason, he decided that his provisional diagnosis would be, and I quote from page 187 of the record, "I did some testing in order to arrive at the diagnosis that insurance companies would honor and the diagnosis that are listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association." His provisional, which is his first diagnosis, apparently had to fit into an insurance category. But what's worse about this is that he administered the MMPI to Mr. Lennon soon after they met, which was within a month or so after Mr. Lennon was arrested. That examination is invalid by his own testimony. It impacted his diagnosis. He admits that. He used an invalid baseline test to conclude that Mr. Lennon has a sexual problem. The L scale elevated, testimony at page 202 of the transcript, and the F scale indicate invalidity. And in fact, the doctor himself testified that the test was invalid. So you have a test in early 03 or so, and then you have a test in October of 05. And at the panel hearing, he testified, Dr. Moss testified, that in part, his conclusion that Mr. Lennon would not reoffend and could return to the practice of law was based on those two tests. Because of that, no one can conclude that the data was good, certainly Dr. Moss, because his baseline test is clearly invalid by his own admission.
Well, then why are you arguing for an indefinite suspension? You should be arguing for a disbarment. If you think that this is a potential for reoffending, to have an attorney engage in the close proximity of relationship with clients, and you talk about the trauma to the victims, why are you arguing for an indefinite?
We agree with Mr. Stern on this point. We think the punishment should be balanced. We think indefinite suspension with an independent medical examination is a balanced approach to this.
Thank you.
So thank you. Back to the medical here, and following up on Justice O'Donnell's question, because I was wondering the same thing. You do think that there is some psychological or mental aspect to this.
Yes.
And that it is capable of treatment and recovery.
Hopefully. That should be up to the independent medical examiner over the course of the next couple of years to make that determination.
Now, when he started this behavior, was he under any particular stress? Is there any reason that it caused it?
Yes, Justice Resnick, there are half a dozen questions about why throughout the transcript, but the bottom line is this. He was counsel to the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state of Ohio. He worked on tax and education issues. He had a good job. Nonetheless, he testified, as did his doctor, that the stress of his everyday work, the stress of the confidentiality that went along with his work, the fact that his girlfriend lived in Cleveland, led him to act out, as he says. So the stressors that he was encountering are nothing more than what we encounter every day. He also did add there was a financial component to it. He had school loans and wasn't sure he could make his payments. So the stresses he felt really were those that most of us feel every day, particularly in this profession. Shall I? I'd like to make a couple of other points, particularly about Dr. Moss, because he is the underlying reason, I believe, that counsel takes the position they do, that this is, in fact, a mental disability, and therefore he should be treated much as other addicts are treated.
And let me interrupt you, Mr. Frick, just to make sure I understand it. From the briefs, I take it that that was the only professional medical or psychiatric evidence that was that's in the record. Is that right?
Correct.
There's no other, okay.
That's correct. On the issue of medication, that is mentioned in the transcript. The panel was very interested in this. Interestingly, Dr. Moss testified that he allows the patient to make the decision as to whether or not there'll be medication. That's at transcript 190, line 6. Let me say it again. He testified that he lets the patient determine whether or not there will be any medication. And upon cross-examination, I ask him, does that mean that the most egregious of antisocial behavior could result in the patient rejecting medication you believe is necessary? And he said yes. So Dr. Moss's opinion, I believe, needs to be tempered by the fact that he allows the patient to make decisions
like
this. Well,
counsel, in treating a psychosis or any level of mental illness, would this psychologist have been the prescribing individual, or would it have been the responsibility of a MD, a physician?
It would have been the responsibility of the physician, and the doctor testified that there is such a person in his office building that he refers to.
Okay, so the psychologist himself could not have prescribed medication.
That is correct, but could have recommended it. Doesn't.
And absent a commitment to via probate court, you can't force medication on someone.
Well, I don't disagree with that. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that a doctor, psychologist, ought to say, if you don't want medication, even though we think it's probably appropriate, you don't have to take it. I think it makes his treatment suspect. And when you add that to the invalidity of the test he admits was invalid, you start to grow the suspicion that the panel had regarding the conclusions of this doctor.
Well, I noticed you haven't argued that it makes the respondent's desire for treatment suspect. Why not? He says, I don't want medication. The doctor says, okay, I'm not going to prescribe it because you're going to ultimately going to determine whether you're going to take it or not. Doesn't that suggest by the patient that the patient isn't willing to do what the patient needs to do to recover or to...
Yes,
it certainly could.
Mr. Lennon testified that he would do anything to avoid it. It'd be the last choice. He doesn't want to do the medication. But if you look at the invalid test, which, by the way, is invalid because the answers were arguably faked, and in fact, the doctor admits that that is a possibility, that the initial MMPI could have been faked. It's intentionally deceptive. Well, one answer to your question, Chief, is that it's possible that Mr. Lennon knew what he was doing, knew he didn't need the medication. He was already playing around with the test. There's also, regarding the psychologist, the reoffending issue. He offered no statistics and no credible evidence regarding reoffending with sexual addiction. And in fact, he said that under stress, we regress. He never did indicate that he had any statistics and didn't know them at the time of the panel hearing. So the panel was left with obviously no guarantee, Justice Resnick, but with no statistics and no opinion other than the doctor thought there'd be a very small chance that he would reoffend. Now, that opinion has to be based on his communication with him, because it couldn't be based on the tests. The tests are invalid. It didn't do well here, did do well here, is an invalid test.
You need to sum up, Mr. Frick.
Pardon me?
You need to sum up. Your red light's been on for
very good,
a little
thank
while.
You.
It's glaring at me.
We agree with the panel, of course, and we agree with it because the trier of fact is actually the best determining body as to the evidence, and we think the sanction imposed is relevant and appropriate. We also think that the practice of law is a privilege, not a right, and we don't think that Mr. Lennon deserves the privilege at this time. We want to make sure that the public is protected and assured that this disciplinary process works. This is a visible case, and I think we should send a message to the bar and to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stern, you've used your time, but you may take, you or Mr. Linden may take 30 seconds.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Steve Linden. I'm the respondent here. I'd like to thank the court for having an opportunity to address the court on this matter. I regret my misconduct that brings us here today. I accept full responsibility for my actions. And today, as I have in the past 3 years, I again apologize to anyone who's been affected by it. Unfortunately, I can't undo the past. All I can do is move forward and do what I can in the future. I've tried to do that in the past 3 years. I hope that the past 3 years, my recovery and rehabilitation should speak something about the authenticity of that recovery and rehabilitation. I've not engaged in misconduct in the past 3 years and have attempted to be a good example through my recovery and rehabilitation. I only hope that this court continues its tradition of considering mental health issues that underlie attorney misconduct. I do not suggest any particular sanction. I leave that to the collective wisdom of this court. I only hope that that my successful treatment is considered in determining the appropriate sanction. And in closing, I would just like to thank this court for hearing me out. I'd like to thank all the people who have loved and supported me throughout this. And I leave the rest to this honorable court. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.